what makes smart people bad writers is this curse of knowledge.
It's almost like I put my arm around the reader and we say, let's talk about what we see. That to me is how I think about basically how to write.
Bezos says, your margin is my opportunity. I always say, your ignorance is my opportunity as a writer.
I'm trying to provide people with some sort of angle, some sort of insight that can make them more effective in their investment process.
Practice analytically, perform intuitively.
Oh man, like, wait, what?
Hey writers, you shouldn't just spend time with all these other writers in this classroom. Go find the consilience between fields. Just live in the world of synthesis.
Right, because the world is constantly changing. What you believed yesterday may not be true tomorrow.
If you love to research, this episode is for you. Michael Mauboussin is a master at researching, distilling, learning, and then taking all those ideas, bringing them together, and then sharing them in public. I've always wondered, how does this guy do it? How is it that he both has such an encyclopedic memory, but also doesn't suffer from that curse of knowledge that so many smart people suffer from? How does he take that encyclopedic memory and write in ways that are clear, that are compelling? I've learned so much from this guy. He also used to be the chairman of the board at the Santa Fe Institute, talks about what he learned from Cormac McCarthy, who was really involved there, what he's learned from other writers there, and then what he's learned being a professor at Columbia Business School. So, hey, let's get to it. Enjoy this conversation with Mr. Michael Mauboussin. The place I want to begin is you just started your 32nd year teaching security analysis at Columbia Business School. And what do you say to your students, your MBA candidates, about learning to write? What's really important in the business world that they need to know?
Well, to me, the big issue is writing is about understanding. So to be able to be an effective writer, especially in things like in the investment world, it means you have to understand. And so that is the foundation upon which all this is built. So, and by the way, it's all kinds of communications, verbal communication and written communication. Verbal communication tends to be a little bit different because I can sit here and look at you, and if you don't know what I'm talking about or puzzled or disagree, I can read that cue from you. Writing is very different, of course, because I'm just handing it over and don't know your reactions to that. But it's really fundamentally to me about understanding. So to be an effective communicator in any form, certainly a writer, the key to start is with understanding.
Yeah, and for you, is the understanding really about research and working through it? Or what does that process of coming to understand something look like for you?
For sure. And by the way, the other thing I'll say, David, has been consistent throughout my career is I think I understand something and then I'm going to write about it. And I'm like, oh my God, I have no idea what I'm doing here. Right. So it forces you to go back to first principles to me. So the way I kind of think about this is really effective for me. It's about learning and then communicating, right? Learning and then writing, for instance, or learning and then teaching. So it's an input and an output, and both of those things are really important. So yes, the answer is it's research and going back and making sure I understand the foundations, poking the spots of weakness, and trying to get into some depth in terms of what's going on. And by the way, that depth, I may not want to convey all that I know even. I want to convey that's what's useful for the reader to read. But yeah, it's fundamentally about understanding and sort of getting your arms around the issues you want to talk about.
Yeah, and I think that there's multiple ways to think about understanding. I think that there's really good one-liners ways to think about understanding, right? You do a really good job of this with the paradox of skill, where you say, here is a one-liner that is a really simple way that you can encapsulate this whole book. But then also there's understanding in terms of how you communicate the idea, how the concepts are structured. And I think that one of the things that's continually surprising to me is just how much work it takes to get to something that is clear and simple, but also just how enlightening something that is clear and simple is, not just for me as a writer, but for the reader. It sticks in their brain. It's easy for them to share. And because of that, there's a real utility to that information.
I try to think a lot about that. You know, you mentioned I started class, and one of the quotes I put up there, it's in Latin, but in English, it's translated as not notations, but notions, from Carl Gauss, a famous mathematician. So don't worry about the formulas, right? The technical things. Understand the concepts. And to me, this is very much what animates as I try to write, is to say, what is the important underlying idea? To your point, if you can distill it and make it straightforward and make it accessible to people, that's really what we're after and we're trying to communicate and write.
The history of that class goes back to writing because Ben Graham taught that class, right?
It's an amazing story. Yeah, he started teaching that class in 1927. So we're coming up on a century of some version of that class being around. He wrote plays. He could translate classics, you know, Greek, Latin. He was an extraordinary guy. But writing was a big part of what, big part of how he got his message out to the world.
When you're working with students, how do you think about the relationship between the spreadsheet and the written word, the synthesis between them? What do students need to know about this, or people work in investing at all?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, numbers are all, having some foundation for what you're doing is really important. But when you're really communicating, a lot of it's about storytelling, right? So in other words, what are these numbers? What is this analysis? What story does this tell? What narrative flows from this that's important for us in terms of guiding our actions or guiding our understanding? So that's, I mean, to me, that's a big part of it. And, you know, it's easy, you know, I'll just say in the investment world as an example, like lots of people use things like multiples of earnings or multiples of cash flow to value things, but they don't necessarily understand the foundations of those multiples because they're shorthand, right? So to me, this is what communication is all about, is making sure that you understand the foundational principles upon which this is built. And then that allows you to, I think, communicate or write much more effectively because you have that foundation established.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to pull out such a proverbial analogy here, but it really is good because it's the iceberg. It is, you only see what's above the water, but there's actually this foundation that you need in order to write well. And we were talking before we started about Steven Pinker and the sense of style and how in chapter three, he talks about the curse of knowledge. And I think that this is a lot of the work that we need to do as writers, is to have that deep understanding, but then somehow retain the clarity of thought and, dare I say, empathy for a reader who doesn't have that same depth, and communicate to them so that as some sort of novice or somebody who definitely doesn't know as much about the topic as you do, that they can still understand what it is that you're saying.
I agree with that 100%. And it's a big challenge, right? And I think, you know, you mentioned the Pinker thing, and he says it quite, you know, bluntly, which is what makes smart people bad writers is this curse of knowledge. You have a lot of stuff going on in your head. Maybe that's the stuff underneath the iceberg, and you're not communicating it in a way that's effective or efficient for the reader. So the key is to make sure, and by the way, making things accessible, acronyms, right? People like to use jargon. Could a high schooler read what we're writing? Maybe not understand every single nuance, but basically get the ideas of what we're doing. Everywhere from that to a finance professor, right, who might be very sophisticated and have lots of experience and training, but would also get something from it of interest.
How do you think about your writing style in terms of the kinds of people that you're trying to appeal to? Because you are going for literally some of the best investors in the entire world. You are trying to write for the elite of the elites. So how do you think about retaining that sophistication, that rigor, while also trying to simplify? And do you find that there is a necessary trade-off there, or do you find that there's no trade-off at all? And actually, the simplicity, even for the people at the top, say you're writing for a Jim Simons or somebody like that, that even they want that sort of simplicity.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the challenge. I mean, that's the goal, is to try to avoid that trade-off and say, I make it interesting. Now, it feels like rule number one is to have something to say, right? So in other words, you've done something that you're excited about, and you want to share it with the world. And that I mean, sounds like trivial, but that is a really important thing. So if I'm working on something, oh, this is a nugget. This is something that's cool. This is something I want to share. And then I'll go back to Pinker. You know, Pinker wrote in that same book, The Sense of Style, chapter two is actually about this. It's all about classic style. And I think classic style is what appeals to me the most. And the way I think about it, David, is it's almost like I put my arm around the reader and we all gaze off into the world, and we say, let's talk about what we see. Let's make this concrete and interesting, and we're going to share this view. And that to me is how I think about basically how to write. And so this idea of you and I, as reader and writer, we're peers looking at the world, giving concrete things that are cool and interesting. So that's, I think, the way that you transcend from the fairly sophisticated person, if it's something new, that's cool for them, to something that's someone that's not maybe completely sophisticated, because they're still part of the whole process.
Concrete. What are you pointing out there?
I mean, concrete is just to try to make the ideas. I mean, there's obviously, we need to use abstractions from time to time, but to make things as concrete and as possible. By the way, That's in our writing. If you read it now, we will do a lot of four examples. We'll give a lot of like little mathematical. I mean, they take up a little bit of space, but not a lot. So if I give you a number, I'm going to show you how that number was derived just so you can see it. So it's something that concrete and you can relate to it and, you know, something that's solid. And I do think people often remember things that are concrete a little bit more effectively.
Yeah, I think so. Well, one of the other things that I've admired about your writing is you love sports and you've been able to basically pull sports into your work. It's funny because I feel a lot of that with golf. So, for example, I was with some students one day and they're like, David, I can't write when you're trying to speak to us so analytically. I need to be in a more intuitive state. And I took a step back and I was like, hold on. How is it that I learn? When I was playing golf, what is it that I tried to think about? Because I was very analytical about my approach to the game, but I wasn't on the 16th hole in a tournament saying, okay, I need to do this crazy thing. And I then said, you know what I used to do? I used to practice analytically and then I would try to perform intuitively.
Correct.
So then I have a piece called exactly that, where I bring in the example of Bryson DeChambeau, who's on the range on Saturday night at the US Open. He's out there till like 10 p.m. He's hitting balls, and he's very analytical. And then there's this quote that he has that he shares in a post-round interview after he wins the US Open, where he says, I finally found that feeling on Saturday night so I could just go play on Sunday.
Yeah, I just love this idea. And it's really about skill acquisition. Sports is very convenient because it's something that's pretty discrete and we can really study it. And look, there are levels of skill acquisition, but that's your point's exactly right. You know, if you're teaching someone to play tennis or golf, you break down the mechanics of it, have people practice. And this is the whole work on deliberate practice, right? To make sure you're at the edge of a skill set, you're working hard on it, right? You're getting feedback that's accurate and timely. And you get better at these different building blocks of the sport. And then when it comes time to play, you want it all flow because you've already done all the practice behind it, right? So these ideas of muscle memory.
I can't take you off the hook first. You mentioned Pinker's classic sense of style. What does that mean to you?
In chapter two of that book, Pinker talks about various styles of writing, and he advocates for classic style, which is one of many. So, and by the way, there's a lot of overlap in these definitions and so on and so forth. And so, you know, for example, Strunk and White, which is another classic book on writing, is more of a practical style, right? So it's almost practical style would be teacher to student. So classic style would be, as I described, is sort of peers looking into the world, finding and describing cool things, trying to make things as concrete as possible so that we're all sort of on the same page. And again, you can avoid a lot of these little traps by avoiding acronyms and jargon and so forth. And just to make it clear, there's a whole nother realm. For example, an academic, you know, I have to read a lot of academic papers for my job.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, no, exactly. And so now you learn how to read these things. And obviously there's a wide range of skills. By the way, finance people tend to be pretty straightforward. You know, they're going to give you an abstract, which is going to summarize it. And usually if they're doing a good job in the introduction, they're going to say, here's sort of the history of what we're doing. So they'll give you the setup. Here's why we think we're adding something to this. And then like, here's what we found. And then the bulk of it is the actual analysis. And then the conclusion will reiterate essentially that. So there is a flow that makes some sense. But, you know, when you're talking to, when you're writing some, like, especially in different subjects, right? Finance is more straightforward and cut and dried, but other realms, right? In the humanities, you're writing papers for other humanities professors, and it gets really abstract very fast, and regular people certainly can't read that stuff with any sort of benefit. So
it's interesting to have traced your work over the years, because there's two sources that I see you referring to a lot. And, you know, I had this with Marshall McLuhan. I read Understanding Media when I was fresh out of college, and there was something about the way that McLuhan explained the similarities and the synthesis between art and culture and architecture and cities and technology, and how all of these things that I thought were totally disparate and different were actually pulling from the same thread. And I was like, what?
Exactly.
And it was this Quake book for me, where I feel like I just look at the world through a McLuhan-esque prism. And for you, that seems to be the Stiglitz paper from 1980, and then also the Wisdom of Crowds. Just shows up over and over and over again. And I think it's a good testament to how deeply you can mine a worthy idea for years, for decades.
For sure. And I mean, let's take those two ideas, because you're exactly right. Let's take those two ideas. Both of them actually relate to something called market efficiency. So let's not get into too many details, but market efficiency basically says, by the way, efficiency like is from physics, right? It's energy and output, right? So in markets, it'd be information goes in, how accurately do asset prices reflect the information, right? So that's, is there slippage, right? That's the measure of efficiency. So there are lots, obviously this is of great academic interest. So there are lots of theories about how this happens. And, you know, one is the rational agent. We all know everything. We all share, you know, the same views of the world. We might have different preferences, but that all gets manifested. No one really believes that, but it's actually not a bad touchstone for thinking about how the world might work in this sort of abstract sense. Fast forward, and, you know, this also ties into the work at the Santa Fe Institute, but Jim Surowiecki writes The Wisdom of Crowds, and the ideas have been percolating for a while. He obviously quotes Francis Galton, a paper that at the time was already a century old.
Hmm.
The Wisdom of Crowds is this really wild idea that just a bunch of people getting together trying to guess something, and by the way, they have incentives and different amounts of money and so forth, just the aggregation of that and often leads to a better answer than the individual. We know that it's better than the individuals on average. You're like, wait, what is this? Like, so that alone was fascinating. And then the other thing that he added on was it's unwilling under certain conditions.
Hmm.
It's conditional.
What are those three again?
So it's diversity, so heterogeneity of the agents, right? Second is aggregation, some way to bring the information together. And the third is incentives, which is rewards for being right and penalties for being wrong. All right, so you might think about, I mean, these things apply, the wisdom of crowds applies to the neurons in your brain, the cells in your immune system, people walking around the city of New York, all these things, right? Heterogeneity, aggregation, and incentives. Now, in markets, it's pretty clear, like, heterogeneity means people, you know, different approaches to the world, different time horizons, different amounts of money. Aggregation is exactly what markets do, right? People say, I want to buy, I want to sell, and it brings it together. And that price is a reflection of that aggregation of information. And then incentives are, if you're good at it, you make money. And if you're bad at it, you lose money. So the people with more money, the smarter people tend to survive, and the not as smart people tend not to survive. So that wisdom of crowds to me is really powerful. It's a way of thinking about broader concept of complex adaptive systems, right? So again, this is a really useful, when you're talking about going back to writing, you say, okay, we want to understand this big thing called market efficiency. There are different theories, but this is one that really, I explain it to you, makes sense. Now, last night you mentioned, you know, we started class and what we do every year is this thing with a jelly bean jar. So we have a jelly bean jar, a bunch of beans in it, and we just hand it around to the students, say, guess how many beans in our jar. And last night's results is the average student, if I just pick someone at random, was off by 50%, 50. The crowd together was off about, we did two versions of it, one off by 14% and the second off by 6%.
Wow.
So we can get a much tighter fit. And by the way, there's some mathematics as to why that works. So now as a writer, as a communicator, you say, okay, here's a cool way to think about markets and here are the conditions. And by the way, the conditions tell us when the wisdom of crowds flips to the madness of crowds. And we know that both of those things exist in the real world. So now we have a bit of a framework. And to me, that's something that's interesting to communicate to readers. The Grossman-Stiglitz thing, you know, this is, again, we're getting into the weeds a little bit.
I actually would love for you to very briefly explain the paper, because as you were giving that answer, I think I realized something about writing that we can get into, which will be some very tactical advice. So explain the paper briefly, and then I think we're going to end up somewhere really interesting.
Right. So at the time, and it's important to set the time frame. So this was published in 1980, which means it was written in the late 1970s. 1970s is probably peak enthusiasm for the efficient market hypothesis, with this idea that information coming in is expressed efficiently in prices. And so there's no, you know, don't even bother trying to do this. So Grossman-Stiglitz come along, they say, you know, this can't really be right? Because there's a cost of gathering information and reflecting in prices, right? And you could think about this as a bunch of investors all over the world scouring research and running models and so forth, trying to get an edge. They say, well, there's a cost, there has to be a requisite benefit. Now, you may argue that cost and benefit offset one another, but there always has to be a benefit to induce people to go off and assume. So they said, the paper's called On the Impossibility of Informationally Efficient Markets. Why? Because as long as there is a cost, there has to be some sort of benefit. That's an inefficiency in the market. that someone's going to be able to be compensated for their efforts. Now, for the rest of us, as normal people, if these people go, they find something, a little nugget of information, they buy or sell, they make a little excess return, that's fine. But in the wake of that, they leave an efficient price. So you and I, we buy an index fund or whatever, we're going to benefit from this work, this basic framework.
Well, the way that this ties so deeply into writing is I can't tell you how many people I speak with who say, either I have nothing to share or everything that's worthy of saying has already been said. So David, there's nothing to write about. I would argue that that very paper proves that wrong. That in the same way that there's a cost to gathering, you can do the same thing. You can go out and you can be the person who gathers. And it's impossible for there to be a perfectly efficient market for information that's out there. And now if you layer on a personal story, oh my goodness, you can add so much. And I think that if you take that idea and you actually apply it into writing, it's very liberating because it effectively proves that if you do the work of gathering domain expertise in a field, you're going to find things to say. And I'm sure you see it over and over again in your work that you've been doing this for decades now, and you still find new things to say that you hadn't seen before. And I would bet that, you know, Bezos says, your margin is my opportunity. I always say, your ignorance is my opportunity as a writer. And as you learn more and more, you realize that the markets for information aren't efficient at all. There's so much BS out there. There's so many open holes of things that no one's ever written about. I'm amazed at how many biographies need to be written that haven't been written before. And the work to do then is to find an area of the world where you're curious, where then you can go become a domain expert. And as you do, I've still never seen somebody do that and not come back to me and say, oh my goodness, there's so many things that I see that no one has shared before that I am so passionate about writing about.
I mean, I love that, number one. And the other thing is, look, the world always changes. And as a consequence, there are always nooks and crannies to be explored as a consequence. One of the recent research reports we worked on is on the concept of increasing returns, right? So in economics, you're taught like decreasing returns. If you have high returns on capital, competition will come in and drive it down. And this idea of increasing returns is, you know, marginal dollar generates more profits. Okay, increasing returns, first described by Adam Smith in Wealth of Nations in 1776, right? You remember the pin factory idea?
Yep.
It's specialization of labor. So Adam Smith had this in 1776. Fast forward, Alfred Marshall, John Stuart Mill, David Ricardo, all these classic economists or political economists talked about this over the centuries. There have been, I think, three or four Nobel Prizes given on work on increasing returns in terms of modern applications of this. So we talk about these five different areas of increasing returns and how they're, you know, how they're relevant. But in each of these areas, there's something new and how the world has changed. One specific example, Paul Romer won the Nobel Prize for this in 2018, is the advent of how information and ideas have become more important in driving economic activity, right? So very much to your point, when you think about writing, and that was, part of what I'm doing here is just a synthesis of something, but it exactly makes your point, which is these ideas have been around for a very long time, but they continue to be developed in an interesting way, and their relevance is greater, I think, or would argue, because the world has changed, and that's super cool. Last thing I'll mention, Paul Krugman is, you know, he's a pretty famous now opinion writer for the New York Times, but he's a Nobel Prize winner in economics, and his area of expertise was international trade. And he's a graduate student in the late 1970s. He goes to a colleague, and the guy's like, ah, what you working on? He's like, oh, international trade. And he's like, dude, like, that's done. Like, we figured all that stuff out, you know? And he's like, no, I don't really think so. See, he actually took a couple little ideas, he called them gadgets, and reorganized it, observed how the world was working, and applied these frameworks and came up with some fascinating insights about international trade and the concept of increasing returns, right? Super cool. That's a perfect example where someone literally said, this topic is done. Exactly your point. Like, everyone's done it. And this guy not only revived it, added huge amounts of incremental intellectual capital, and won the Nobel Prize for it, right? So to your point, I completely agree with that. And it's not just, there are obviously many ideas that are out there, but it's how those ideas are applied to the world as it changes. And that's also very important.
Let me ask just a super basic, like, Joe man off the street question. I'll even do an accent for it.
Michael,
what is it that you really do for a living? Why do people hire you?
It's a good question.
I know that you have your papers. I know you've worked at all these big companies, but why is it that people hire you, and how do you think about your job and your career?
Yeah. I mean, I think I'll just sort of try to describe a little bit of what I do and then how I think about it, right? So in theory, it's really three parts to what I do. One is to work with investors on the investment process. Obviously, the firm where I am now, the idea is to make our own folks as effective as they can in their investment process, right? So it's a lot of internal communication. It's sometimes formal conversations, but a lot of it's more informal type of stuff. The second thing is research, and that's where the writing comes into play, obviously, the most. So the research is, can we write about things that are important and relevant to investors, not just our own team, but also we share this with the world, broadly speaking. We could talk maybe about the buckets. And then the third would be external stuff. You know, are there conferences that are useful to talk to, or clients, or what have you? When I think about my own self, I always just think about, okay, what makes me happiest? Like, what makes me, most effective is this constant flow of input, which is basically learning, and then output, which is basically teaching or communication. So the output would include teaching a course, giving a talk, but a very, very, very big part of that is writing. So it's input, output. And by the way, if I'm doing a lot of output, not input, I feel out of balance. If I'm doing a lot of input and I'm not outputting, so I'm not synthesizing for myself, I feel out of balance. So effectively, it is essentially teaching, right? It's just teaching is sort of what it distills down to. So I think that would be the value. And the other thing I would just say is, you think about your own life, and you think about the teachers who inspired you, the teachers who you thought were great. They're almost all, to an individual, great learners. And so learning is, I think, a prerequisite to teaching. Learning is a prerequisite to writing, right? This is just so important. So when people say, I need something to say, the answer is because you've learned something cool and you think other people should know about that. You want to share it with the world.
Tell me about this guy, Lawrence Gonzalez. You say he's got this old soul, old school sensibility about him. So let's start there.
Well, I first met Lawrence in probably 2005, 2006. He wrote a book called Deep Survival, which I would highly recommend to people. The subtitle, which kind of gives away the whole theme, is Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why? So this is people that get themselves into extreme situations for good reasons or bad reasons, and then who survives this. So I wrote a book in 2009 called Think Twice. And it's about exactly what the title says, you know, when you are faced with certain types of situations, your mind's going to want to think about it one way, but sometimes you should pause and try to think about it a different way. Think twice. Okay. So, I write the book. It's relatively short. And, you know, I think many authors do this. I send it to friends and say, give it a read and let me know what you think. And, you know, most people send it back and go, oh, yeah, it was great. You know, it's awesome. You know, page 57, I'm not sure that you got this wrong. You spelled this guy's name wrong on page 92, whatever. You know, but they're basically like, Lawrence emails me back and he goes, what kind of treatment would you like me to give this? I'm like, what do you mean by that? He goes, well, I'd like to line edit this for you. So I'm like, knock yourself out. So, you know, a few weeks later, it shows up in my inbox. And, you know, I have a deadline to submit it back to the publisher. And I'm thinking, you know, usually I go through edits, not that hard. I think I spent literally a week going through his edits of a relatively short book. And the reason they were so powerful was not only was he correcting things that should have been corrected, but he was teaching me about writing along the way. And I was like, he's like, here's a mistake you keep making. Here's something you should be doing. Here's how I recommend you treat this. And I was like, revelation after revelation. You're like, oh man, like, wait, what? Like, why was I doing this way? So for me, those got reflected in the final version, but I think it was just the reverberations were vastly greater than that because it spilled into everything I did subsequent to that. So by the way, I had him hired as the editor for The Success Equation, the next book after that, for the same types of reasons. And the other thing that's fun for me about a guy like Lawrence is he knows nothing about finance. Well, I shouldn't say nothing, but he's not a finance professional, which is perfect, right? Because going back to your point, I want an audience, I want someone to say, if it's clearly written and concrete and useful, that anybody, it should be accessible to anybody. I don't have to be a finance professional. And so that was it's also very beneficial. So you're like, why are you using this technical term when a simpler term would do the same thing and get the job done, right? So I'm like, those are the kinds of things. So Lawrence is great, and you know, I talk to him quite frequently. The other thing I like about him, you mentioned this, he does have a little bit of the old school. By the way, he's taught historically writing at Northwestern, right, which is one of the great journalism schools. So he's edited and published, and he's written across all different genres and so forth. But he's a little bit old school, and I kind of like that. So I'll give you one example. So I write Think Twice, and I use the word error and mistake interchangeably. And by the way, luck, fortune, chance, right? But go back to error and mistake. And he's like, do you know the difference between an error and a mistake? I'm like, I just wrote a whole book about this and I have no idea, right? And so he'll go into etymology, like here, where do these words come from? And like, what do they really mean? And do you mean error versus mistake? And by the way, an error is typically when you do something wrong when you should have known to do it the right way. Right. And a mistake is you just did something wrong, which you may not have had a reason to do it the proper way. Right. So anyway, it's kind of a fascinating thing. So he's like, you're dealing with errors or mistakes. So I'm like, okay, I should just be more mindful. I should be more mindful of the words that I'm using. I should be more mindful of where these things came from. And I'll just say, by the way, the other thing I was going to say about in terms of writing for me personally is I'm just a huge fan of trying to understand the intellectual evolution of ideas. Because if you're writing about something today, it's very nice to know where it came from, why we are where we are today, and then where it might go into the future. And it's like people sometimes dismiss that. It's funny, you know, Columbia Business School, you mentioned Ben Graham, he's obviously very famous. But there are guys like this guy named John Burrell Williams, who wrote a book about investing in the 1930s. Very, very profound book, very important contribution. Students don't know his name, never heard of him. So I'm like, to really understand where you are today in a particular domain, it could be any kind of domain, I find it super helpful to understand the history. So that's a little bit that sensibility is also a sensibility that Lawrence would share.
You know, you talk about the evolution of ideas. That's how I feel with the evolution of words. And first of all, I don't know if this book exists. If it does, I would like somebody to email me what the best book is on this topic. But I would love to see a book where every chapter is about the evolution of a word. So I'll throw out two chapters. Like if I were to get started on this book, the first would be the word innovation. So early on, we think of innovation now as an unequivocally positive word. It actually used to mean exactly its opposite, that innovation was a bad thing. Why would innovation be a bad thing? 12th, 13th, 14th century? Because innovation meant going against the nature of the world, which was created by God. So to innovate would actually be an ungodly, almost profane way of thinking. And obviously we've had a huge shift. Maybe in the 17th, 18th century is a bit more of a neutral term. And so you can see, okay, why is it that we've gone from such a negative connotation to such a positive connotation? Another word is the word inspire. Inspire. Okay, so what does inspire mean? In spirit. Okay, well, the same spirit in Hebrew, ruach, wind, then Yahweh, right? When you say Yahweh, which is the Hebrew word for God, it's breathing, Yah, in, Weh, right? The Yahweh is breath, and that the spirit is always aligned with the breath. So it's your in spirit, and you're almost inhaling and exhaling. And you can find so much by doing x-ray vision on a word or an idea. And this is just one of the places that I love to look for. Like if I'm going on GPT and I just am trying to find an idea, I'll follow the etymology of a word and it always hits. It always hits.
I'm very much in that same, I love that same vibe, which is going back and understanding where things come from. I'll just mention as a complete side note.
Yeah.
You know, I was a government major in college, an economics minor, but two of my favorite courses were Hebrew scriptures and power and politics in the biblical tradition, believe it or not, which were taught by a Jesuit. And so we learned about a lot of these ancient scriptures. And by the way, what was fascinating is that you learn about what scriptures are the ones that are passed down or read today. And you also learned about other writings that were contemporary that were passed over. So we actually, and they still exist, but they're not considered to be part of a canon, right? So what were those people writing about? Why were they writing? Why did they come up with these stories? What were they trying to address? Completely fascinating, right? Anyway, so that's a side, complete side story.
I spend a lot of time looking now at ancient Greek. Every day I'll look up something. And right now it's probably my biggest source of paradigm shifting ideas in my life.
Look, when I think about trying to be an effective writer, so much of it is about reading and knowing what you like to read, knowing what's effective as a reader, reading other authors and what works and what doesn't work for you. And I, by the way, I love to do those, like understand the history and read people who are going to do that. But so much of like how, what I do and how my sensibility is really framed in large degree by what I like to read and what kinds of things resonate and click with me. The other thing that's interesting I'll mention, just an observation, is there are people who are deemed to be very great writers who I don't connect with. And the example that comes to mind is Stephen Jay Gould, who's a very famous biologist and very famous essayist and celebrated, I think, in those ways. When every time I read, and I'm like, okay, I'm sure it's just I was whiffing last time.
This time will be different.
This time I'm going to get a cup of coffee. I'm like ready to go get into it. And I'm like, it just doesn't do it. And now that's idiosyncratic. I'm sure, and by definition, many, many other people have a lot of success and joy in reading that. So it's a funny thing. Like, so what kind of writers are the ones I click with? What kind of writers do I not click with? And of course, I'm going to naturally try to, all of us are amalgamations of different styles. I'm going to try to do more of that stuff that works for me.
Sure. Tell me about your research process. And I want to hear about one thing in particular. The number one thing I struggle with research is that I begin to use it as a justification for procrastination, where I'll say, oh, I'm just researching. And even now, I still haven't found a way to almost research in a way that I have integrity with myself, because I get down rabbit holes. The inefficiency of research is both a feature and a bug. And when I'm on a deadline and life is busy, I mean, you have 5 kids. So when life is busy, it's hard for me to justify it. But I know that there's something there that you must have figured out.
Yeah, I mean, I wish, you know, when you say research, you know, basically, if you follow the thread of what I tend to write about, or our team tends to write about, it's usually stuff that I feel like I need to know more about than I do. So you keep using this rabbit hole. It's usually some sort of rabbit hole. So, and I do try to confine it to that particular topic. So if you go back and read what we've done, they're usually things that are they're sort of projects that have almost like a beginning and an ending and a story that comes out of it. So that for me tends to be not a big problem. Now, sometimes we'll do work and there'll be a bunch of loose ends that haven't been tied up, which I just will take note of, and those end up potentially becoming new projects. There's a funny story about Think Twice, is that there was a chapter in Think Twice about luck and skill. And I thought I was really, really fond of this chapter. So I made a chapter 2. And my editor reads the book from the publisher and she is like, skill luck chapter, you know, it's fine. I don't think you should cut it, but like, I don't think you want it to be chapter 2. Kind of move it to the back of the book. So it ends up being like the last chapter. So the book goes out into the world and I start getting calls from people and emails from people. And they're like, oh, this book, really like blah, blah, blah. But man, that luck and skill stuff, that was really cool. You should talk about that more. So I'm like, I knew it was important, right? So the success equation ends up being a spinoff of that chapter, acknowledging that I didn't do the topic justice, that there was a lot more that could be done. And, you know, it's sort of a funny, so that's an example. So I did some research to do the original chapter, but there were just lots of loose ends. And it turns out tying up those loose ends, and by the way, even the success version had lots of loose ends, but tying up those loose ends itself becomes another book, right? Which is interesting.
Well, we see this a lot in how people think about the notion of progress in society, where they'll say, oh, we've hit some sort of dead end. But the thing I find time and again is that answering a question in depth opens up new questions. And my favorite description of this comes from Nassim Taleb. He says that all my books were born out of the ribs of my previous book. So he's always following this same core idea of risk and how we think about risk wrong. But he starts with Fooled by Randomness, which then leads to The Black Swan, which then leads to Anti-Fragile, which then leads to, I think, Skin in the Game is his 4th one. And everyone, it's following that same thread, but you're eventually finding new things. And he writes a book, say, every 5 years. And he's like, that's about how long it takes me to explore the new question, write it out, and publish it.
And I'll say, you know, by the way, Fooled by Randomness, if you said, like, what is the genesis of the success, ultimately the success equation, it was two books. One was Fooled by Randomness.
Really?
Where that came out in 2001. And I read it and I was like, absolutely makes sense. I mean, I was sort of aware of it, but brought the point home that life has gotten much more random than we thought. But I was left a little bit wanting in the sense that I didn't know how to figure it out. Like, how much randomness is there? And then in Moneyball in 2003, which influenced a lot of people, but Moneyball is almost like the opposite story, which is we can use numbers and analysis to find skill and maybe find skill where people are not looking for it. So I was like, okay, here's thing on luck. Here's the thing. Can we like bring these two ideas together and create a framework to allow us to understand the relative contributions of these two things, luck and skill, which is super cool. So that ended up being, and of course, people have written about, I mentioned Stephen Jay Gould, who I didn't like reading, but The Paradox of Skill, which is the name I gave it, but that's Stephen Jay Gould's idea. I got that from reading his book, Full House. And in the book, I give him full attribution. So it's not like, I'm not pretending like I came up with it, but that was Stephen Jay Gould's idea. So I read that from him. So there are examples of like pulling things from different fields to try to come up with something that can be useful for folks.
So, Michael, so I'm a writer. I come to you and I say, hey, I'm really trying to build a career and I want to be excellent at what I do in my writing. You've worked in investing for so many years with people who are always on the search to find their edge. How do I think about finding my edge as a writer based on what you've learned as an investor?
To me, there are two key aspects. One is to do work that is interesting, right? To whether it's research or have an observation or an insight that's interesting. And look, it is true that a lot of things have been said before, but it is also true that there are a lot of interesting ways to apply ideas. So having something interesting to say is the prerequisite for all this stuff. And then the second is trying to communicate it in an effective fashion, right? So write it well. And there are plenty of people that have great ideas that can't spit it out. There are people who have great ideas that have the curse of knowledge that do a poor job, but try to write it well. And you know what I say to everyone comes to me and says, oh, I'd like to write a book. Or like, the first thing I say to them is, before you go too far, you should get an editor. Because an editor, a good editor is worth his or her weight in gold, from my point of view, right? And that is everything from doing the sort of nuts and bolts of the editing, but also make sure the structure makes sense. Maybe someone who's not fully initiated with your industry so they can ask questions, making sure that you're addressing naive questions, right? So to me, those would be two things, is have a good idea and then make sure that you're structured to communicate it effectively.
Tell me about your process for outlining. You do it very deliberately. I'm a little bit less of a planner. For me, the way that I write is I generally find some sort of one-liner or some story at the beginning that encapsulates what I'm trying to say. And then I make sure that everything I'm saying sort of pivots around that core idea and orbits around it. And then so long as things orbit around it, then I can always use that core idea as a razor for when I'm in the editing process. If it relates to that one sentence, one paragraph, then I keep it. And if it doesn't, I cut it. But you write a little differently with outlines. So what does that look like for you?
Yeah, I do try to think about, and I love this idea of like the key idea, the one-liner is the razor. I do like that idea a lot. But usually it's like, here's something we're trying to convey. Here's what our, and usually, by the way, it's bubbling up from research, right? So here's what our research finding is. And then we're going to go through this in a fairly, and a lot of what we do is fairly linear in terms of what we're doing, explaining things. So and then I try to outline. And by the way, that's the thing, is outlining also forces you to think about, and this is when you say like, what do I stay up at night thinking about in the middle of the night? It's almost always like the flow of how things work. So making sure that the flow makes sense, that we're building on something, that we're reinforcing the theme. Often there are things I don't know how to communicate them. So that's the kind of stuff that sort of bangs around in my head till I sort of figure that out. But I do like to work out of outlines because usually I'm like, this is what, this is encapsulated in this story. And as a consequence, I want to be able to touch on each of these things effectively. We do, you know, like, but the thing is, in that process, usually in the outline is where I usually do most of my killing, turns out, that I'll say, like, this is an idea I think is really interesting. I was actually thinking about this even today as I was coming in to New York. I was like, here's this thing that's kind of interesting and this thing we're working on now. I'm like, you know, but it just doesn't feel like it's not in the right spot here. So we're going to kill it. So I'm just going to go back and exit out. So I don't know if there's a good answer to that. I think everybody probably has their own little method, but.
And walk me through, how is an outline different for a paper that you would write versus a book? How are those the same and different?
Well, I think that they're very similar in the sense that the chapters would be basically I would outline the chapters basically. I'm actually thinking about doing a book now. And once again, the key is, you know, what do I have to say and how to do all that kind of stuff. And so I'm sort of thinking about that, literally that process now. And part of it is also, it is working on flow, right? So in other words, as one chapter goes to the next chapter, making sure that there's some reason for the reader to go to the next chapter and almost like a lead into the next chapter. So yeah, it's just, to me, those are just subcomponents to build up to the bigger component of a book.
You at the Santa Fe Institute, you literally got to spend time with Cormac McCarthy, who has to be one of the best American novelists of the 20th century. What did you learn from him about writing?
That he's a lot better at it than me. I balk at the idea that I am a writer, and hanging out with somebody like Cormac for 10 minutes underscores why I can't be even put in the same sentence. But a couple observations about him just in general is first of all, well, he was brilliant. He was brilliant and read and knew about a staggering array of topics. And so he would go to a lot of scientific meetings and he would hang out with a lot of scientists talking about science, right? And yet when you read the books he would write, of course, yeah, whether that permeated or not is another question. He was also an incredible reader. Mm. And that's another thing that I took away from all this is it's very difficult to separate, you know, to be a great writer, it seems to me you have to be a great reader and you have to be probably a pretty prolific reader. And he certainly was all those things. But I think that, and he didn't like to talk about, at least to me, maybe talked about it with others. He didn't like to talk much about his writing process, but I think that, my sense very much was it was almost like to some degree, he worked very hard at it in the craft, but it was almost like a gift for him. And it was almost like his reason to be, his art of his writing. So that's just my sense of it. And that's, so, you know, it's interesting. You think about people who are really, really elite at what they do, you know, Tom Brady or, you know, Cormac McCarthy, it's almost what they do is the thing. And it's very difficult to, you know, even deal with other things around that when you have that much ability and skill and passion and devotion.
Well, you had mentioned that it was almost like he was channeling the divine something.
I mean, that would be my sense is, you know, we had a conversation about this one time and he sort of said, you know, the ideas are coming and I'm just basically typing. So obviously he actually wrote one nonfiction essay a few years ago. And it was talking about this sort of subconscious, how our minds work, right? So much of what we do is happening behind the scenes. Sleep is a good area, an important area for all that kind of stuff. And I think he wrote that essay in part reflecting sort of his own process, that he was obviously, these things were constantly working in his mind. So when he got sat down to the typewriter, the things flowed. Again, there was a lot going on, but the things flowed, and it was almost like he was dictating what was happening in his mind, which is it's hard. Certainly, it's nothing I can relate to personally. And I also think that writing fiction is just a completely different, wholly different game than writing nonfiction. So I writing fiction for me is like beyond what I could even think about.
Well, he wrote the mission statement for Santa Fe Institute, right?
That mission statement is awesome. By the way.
It's so good.
It's so good.
It's so good. It's like, oh.
It's so good. And, you know, there is a video of him reading it, which is even better. So
oh, really?
It's worth it. We should, I don't know if we have show notes, but we should put it on there. Because yeah. He does go through it. Because he basically says, like, you know, they gave me this mission statement and I crumpled it up and threw it in the garbage trash can, started anew. And he typed it out and he said he reads it. And, you know, he's got one, there's like one line in there, I'm paraphrasing, but it's something like, you know, so every now and then someone shows up who's crazy and that makes us really happy, right? So this idea that we're going to be very indulgent of sort of stuff that's out there a little bit, which I love. It's great.
Have you had moments in your career where you wrote something and you looked at it and you said, how did I write that? Or has it always felt like this very rational, logical, aware process?
It's funny you say that, because sometimes I go back and reread stuff I wrote and I'm like, oh, I didn't remember that, or like that was the, but no, not so much. But I will say there are a couple, what I would say is there were some reports to me that were extraordinarily difficult. And I felt that they were big, you know, like it was a lot to do. One was a piece we called, I called it Shift Happens, inspired by Kuhn. But the idea is, how do we understand markets and thinking about markets as complex systems? And the reason that was difficult is because what I was attempting to do is to create a bridge between sort of what is classic theory and this notion of complex systems or wisdom of crowds. So in writing, when you're writing, you have to bring a reader along. And by the way, that's what I try to do with my students, is bring them along. So I want you to start on familiar territory, what you've been taught in school, and then I'm going to move you to thinking about this and introduce why thinking about markets as complex systems gives you all the benefits of what you knew on your firm foundation, but also adds things that are relevant to the world. So that was one.
You know, I want to just pause you there, because I think that is a very good formula for thinking about writing, which is you're going to write a piece that has two sections. The first section is something that you're familiar with. And now you're on the rock climbing wall and you have your grip, your feet are in a good place, you know this landscape well, and you can write about it well. That's going to be your confidence. And you're going to write that out, you're going to explain it well, and then what you're going to do is you're going to take one leap. And it's sort of like when you're rock climbing and you take your arm, you're like, ah!
Exactly.
And you try to get that next area. And that works well when you're writing. It's just, I know this. Now from this, I'm going to go on to something else. It's a very good formula for people yep. who are struggling to write and trying to get going.
So I love that. The second report I'll say that's related to that was called Measuring the Moat. And it's ended up being quite, you know, it's out there a fair bit. And I wrote that more than 20 years ago. But that was really a job. And a lot of what I do is synthesis, but that was like one of the hardest pieces of synthesis that I ever did, right? So I've been reading all this stuff on strategy, so reading Michael Porter and Clay Christensen and all these other folks. But I was like, this is not really, and I've been writing microeconomics, but it really hadn't been brought together in a framework that you could go through and sort of have a checklist. And so I just sat down and just started going through this material and like, how do I, you know, again, how do I organize this in such a way that I can allow the reader to go through this from lay of the land, big picture, to industry issues, to firm-specific issues, to guide them through this with frameworks to allow them to come to a sensible conclusion. So, it, you know, now it's like seems, now I go through this and I teach it and it seems like, oh, this is obvious, easy, right? But that the putting that all, synthesizing that was extraordinarily, for me at least, very, very, very difficult.
Yeah, in the philosophical tradition, there's a long lineage of people who study other philosophers for decades at times. And they study this philosopher, maybe they'll do a second one and then a third one. And only later in their career do they begin to make some sort of original contribution. And in your world of business analysis, I think there are some great synopses that I've seen. For example, I've never read Michael Porter, but there's a great book called Understanding Michael Porter. And I think that there's an opportunity for people who want to do the kind of work that you've done and also get their name out there to take somebody like a Clayton Christensen or the guy who wrote Seven Powers at Stanford or Michael Porter. Like, for example, here's a simple one. How would you combine Brian Arthur's paper that he wrote out of the Santa Fe Institute in the 90s around accumulating advantages? How would you combine that with Michael Porter? And you just synthesize those two ideas. Take one idea here, one idea there, and you say, where do they agree? Where do they disagree? Now, what does that mean? And I say all this because in your sphere, there is so much opportunity and financial upside for people who can do this well. And rather than trying to make original contributions, what I'm hearing from you is just live in the world of synthesis. And if you live in that world of synthesis and you read widely enough and take notes well enough and put stuff out there, good things happen, and good things happen without you having this like divine revelation that comes from zero to one. Like, where did that come from? It really can be a systematic process of getting your name out there as a writer.
100%. And, you know, the other thing about markets, there are sort of two aspects about markets. One is they constantly change, right? So the nature of how companies invest, the businesses they're in, all that stuff is very different today than, say, a century ago. The second is there tend to be cycles, right? The same thing, the same movie plays different casts of characters and so forth, but the same movies play. So again, when you think about this idea of synthesis, I'll give you one example that I think is a fascinating one. And again, you can go, I mean, I got the inspiration from this was actually from neurobiology of all things, right? But this is fascinating. So turns out the number of neurons in your brain doesn't change that much throughout your life. It's about 85 billion. But what happens is the number of synaptic connections changes wildly. So from the time you're born to the time you're about 3 years old, there's this huge upswing, and then there's this huge pruning process. There's another little bump. Okay. And then as an adult, it levels off. Okay. So you're going, what's going on with this, right? Like if you meet a three-year-old, right? They're kind of buzzing with activity. They're very open to the world, but they're kind of inefficient, right? In a sense. Okay. And so the pruning is we're going to get rid of those synaptic connections that are not used, right? But it turns out that when you study this, this is one of the most efficient ways to learn about an environment. Try stuff out, use the stuff that works, kill the stuff that doesn't work. So I'm reading this, I'm like, okay, that's interesting. And then I'm like, industry development. Turns out there's this famous work on this by Stephen Klepper, and it's the exact same pattern. Industry development follows the same pattern. Huge upswing in number of competitors, gets to an apex, and then it comes back down again. It, in retrospect, looks incredibly wasteful. Why were we shipping 50-pound bags of dog food in the dot-com era or whatever? But it turns out what they're doing is searching the space. So this pattern is played out over and over and over. So again, that synthesis says, oh, if I have this framework, it allows me to understand how and why this is happening. And we can see the repercussions from historical precedent and how that might apply to what we're facing today. Super cool. And so that those are the kinds of things that are recurring themes for sure.
You know, I think back to my own life. There were many years where I was basically a speed reader. I would read this and that. I'd read as many books as I possibly could. I was just voracious. Basically for 5 years, every day was basically about how much information can I consume? And I read so many things that I didn't have interest in, but now I read very differently. Now I'm very careful. I find something that I'm going to read and I go super deep. I read around things. So if I find a book I like, I'll read three books that inspired that author that I see them referencing a lot in the footnotes and the hyperlinks or whatever. But early on, it was that voracious reading. And you know what? It was the same thing with writing, where now that I've been writing for seriously for almost a decade, I want to just write great pieces. I want to write the best thing that I can write. And I want to do the work, do the thinking. I want to be dreaming about a piece for weeks, months at a time before I ship something. And then I want to ship it and I want to be really proud of it. And I want that piece to be read for many years into the future. But I wrote 50 articles in 50 days at a time where I would wake up and I'd just go boom, 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 boom. And it's that same pruning process that you're talking
about. So I wonder, David, I should ask you this because, you know, I mentioned this piece we're working on in increasing returns. And one of the key ideas is learning by doing, right? And it turns out you get better at something by learning by doing. And writing to me feels very much that way, which is there's no substitute for hard work and just basically getting after it. And it doesn't mean everything you're going to produce is going to be good. But this idea of doing it. And yet the other thing that would be helpful is to get good feedback, right? So having, again, someone who's trusted, whether it's an editor, to work with you. But I like you said, everyone's going to have their own way, their own path. And so there's no substitute for getting after it.
Yeah. My favorite little story is that the Beatles started off as a cover band.
Right.
So even the Beatles, they were covering other artists before they made their own album.
You know, over last year, I'm embarrassed to say this, I hadn't read it before, but I read Stephen King's book On Writing. Have you read that book?
I actually haven't.
Yeah, so I've actually read, here's my embarrassing.
It's so embarrassing.
Here's my embarrassing admission is I've not read any Stephen King novels, although I know he's a great writer. And I actually talk about Richard Bachman, his pseudonym, in one of my other books. But he wrote a book called On Writing. And, you know, the guy's a very talented guy. But two things that really hit me. One is, he's an incredible reader. So he does read a lot and reads across lots of different things. But second is that guy's a hardworking dude.
Yeah.
He's a hardworking dude. And it's just like, he's banging it out, right? So even Stephen King, people should realize it's hard work. Well, it's like anything. Like people, there was a big poker phase. Everyone thinks, I want to be a professional poker. Being a professional poker player is a grind, right? It's hard work. So being a great writer is hard work. And there's no substitute for just banging it out.
Are you a show up every day kind of guy or write for a long time kind of guy?
No, it's really grinding it out. I will say that writing for me to be effective at it, it does require blocks of time. So I can, you know, even when I was writing my first book, which I co-authored, I had this sort of illusion that I could, heck it out on a train or on a plane ride or like that. No, it just doesn't work. So I really need to be in the zone. I was actually talking about some folks earlier today. I used to also from time to time have music on. I now do none of that. So no complete silence, by the way, when I work. So that's the other interesting aspect.
And what is the nature of your editing process? What do you feel like is the usual difference between draft 2 to draft 4, 5? Like, what are the big themes in terms of how your writing evolves?
Yeah, I mean, by the way, this is something where we don't really have, I work with a guy named Dan Callahan. Dan's amazing. He's a great partner. And we, between the two of us, we essentially edit what we do. So, and that's not an ideal solution, by the way. It'd be great to have an external editor. So I'll talk about books in a minute. But the answer is we just iterate over and over. We don't usually cut tons of stuff out, but we are almost always spending a lot of time on polishing. Now, you mentioned before, like, you know, often when I read an older piece, I'm like, oh, I wish I'd said this differently, or this word would have been better than that word. I mean, there's always going to be that kind of stuff. So nothing's ever perfect for sure. By the way, it was interesting. So I said, one at a time, I asked Cormac, like, when do you know when you're done? And he says, when I pull the manuscript out of the drawer and I don't want to change a single word.
It's a high bar.
Oh, man, that was a high bar. Like, I would never have written like my first paragraph of my whole life if that were true. So, I mean, he's working on a different level. And a lot of it is words. It's making sure that we're doing things like the structure of everything makes sense, the flow of it makes sense. Obviously, we're checking for all the analysis so that makes sense. So things will evolve a bit from beginning. Now, when I'm writing books, it's so much different because we have external editors. And so we have cut out big chunks of things before. Now, I tend to try to be very mindful of, you know, if we're going to work for shoot for a certain word limit. I'm not a guy that writes 150,000 words for a 50,000 word book and cuts 2/3 of it. So I try to be a little bit more measured in that way. But editing is obviously really important. So it is always good. We always try to let things sort of sit around for a while and come back to it after some time to make sure that we're fresh eyes and energy.
One of the things I've really been enjoying working on, because I've needed to work on this in my own writing, is injecting my own personality into later drafts. I find that at first, my mental horsepower needs to be to the structure, getting the ideas down, making sure it's logical and that it flows well. But generally what I find is a few things. When I work with my editor, he says, I need more of you in the piece. I need more of you. And I actually think this is becoming more and more important now with AI, that the way to counter AI is to bring more of your humanity, more of your personality, that people want to be with the reader. They want to feel like they're with you. You know, David Foster Wallace always said that literature was almost this cure for loneliness.
Right.
I love it when you're with somebody else and you're crawling through their mind like a McDonald's playhouse or something. And what I try to do first is I try to say, what are the personal stories that I can tell, the personal anecdotes? And then just trying to play around. And Amor Towles was sitting in the same chair that you're sitting in now yesterday. And this is what he said, that once he can get the left brain analytical writing done, that then opens up the opportunity for him to play around with the right brain stuff. But it's only once the structure and the foundation is there that he can do that. And I feel very much the same way.
Give me an example. Like, what would it be?
Okay, so I just wrote a piece about, I became a Christian last year. And I was talking about how I'd never read a book like I'd learned to read the Bible. And my editor was like, David, you have to give me an example, that's going to allow me to see where you were. He's like, I hear you, but I don't feel you. And I said, what is something? It was also a heavy piece, right? So I needed something light. I needed something that would reveal what I was trying to say and that expressed a sense of personality and a sense of place as well.
Yeah, exactly.
So I talked about how one time I even spent 2 hours studying four verses, the book of John, verses 1-4, at a Schlotsky's in the hill country of Texas. And you can see it. And Schlotsky's is a funny name. It's like, what, Schlotsky's? It's the Texas hill country. So it evokes a sense of place. And once I have that, all of a sudden, something that seems dry begins to come alive. But there were iterations and iterations and iterations just to get to that sentence.
Right. And that's, you know, I mentioned before, like this idea of concrete. That's a perfect, I think to me, that's a perfect illustration of concrete. But I need to think more about this because I like that. Obviously, like many other people, I try to tell stories. And so storytelling, often there's stories about some experience that I had that could be helpful. But I need to think more about that because, you know, the kind of stuff we're doing is, and by the way, some of the stuff we do is like really like, here's how to do a certain type of analysis. It's pretty boring stuff, right? So you're trying to bring some life to it, but it's not hard to tell a story that's like a moving story about it. But yeah, even like the success equation, I opened a story about how I got a job, which is a completely random thing, you know, and that was, you know, so I don't know if that like makes it more relatable. But it's funny because people will say to me, oh, tell me the stories about the trash can, like you're the trash can guy, right? Stuff like, something like that. So they do relate it. They remember that.
It is a great story. It's, you got the Washington Redskins trash can over there.
It's probably because they only read the first three pages. Anyway, that might be it.
Right, but that's a great example of what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people who I'd say you work with, just people in the investment finance industry, when I look at their writing, basically, this is true for very, very smart people. What I see is that they have great insights, which serves them well, but they're almost afraid to talk about themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that often in order for them to succeed, they feel that they need to suppress part of who they are, which really hurts them in their writing. So they don't talk about themselves, they write without personality, and their writing becomes dry and stale. So there's just huge alpha in being able to counter that a little.
That's interesting, yeah. I mean, in December we wrote a piece and I did start with a story about something, like an experience I'd gone through. So it was about, the report was about pattern recognition, and I try to make it a little bit more relatable by explaining a situation where I'd seen this happen and it didn't work out well.
Matt Levine's a good example of someone who just writes with vigor.
That guy is a certifiable genius, by the way. He's amazing. I mean, amazing. And like, I was thinking to myself, I mean, I don't know how he does it. Like, literally, I mean, I think I do know how he does it, but like, it's incredible to be that smart. And, you know, sometimes people say, like, who are the people I drop what I'm doing to read what they've written? And Matt Levine is one of the guys. I really do. Like, I stop what I'm doing today and I'll read his newsletter. Damn.
Well, Michael, thank you so much. Thanks for all your writing and the success equation in particular. I love that book. I love the idea of the paradox of skill. I love that idea. So thank you so much for your writing and thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, David. My pleasure.